Greetings, one and all. This is Guthrie Govan from the UK, and you're listening to The Guitar Channel. In other words, you're listening to the right thing. Congratulations on your choice. The Guitar Channel rocks. Cheers.
Welcome to The Guitar Channel, passion amplifier for all the guitar fans, with interviews of stars from Steve Lukather to Paul Gilbert, Steve Vai, Pop Achebe, Nuno Betancourt, and many more, as well as other less famous musicians but as talentful. The Guitar Channel is also Gear Soundsing, where I present you with audio and or video reviews of guitars, effects and other music gear. My name is Pierre Journel and I am very happy to welcome you to another episode of the show. In a couple of seconds, you are going to listen to a Skype interview I did with Guthrie Govan for the release of the second studio album from the Aristocrats, Culture Clash, which was released on July 16th. In the next episode, I will publish an interview I did with Brian Beller, who plays bass for the Aristocrats. As usual, before the interview, I will play you extract from this great album. The backstage bonus for this show is the full backing track for the song called Dance of the Aristocrats, as well as a 10% discount code to purchase additional Aristocrats backing tracks and transcriptions from jamtrackcentral.com. So here we go with some music from Culture Clash, then the interview with Guthrie. Okay, so here we go. I am very happy to have on the other side of the Skype connection Guthrie Govan himself. So Guthrie, how are you doing today?
Pretty good. Mm-hmm. That's the short answer. I'll spare you all the morbid details. could be worse.
I know you are very, very busy, so thanks a lot for the opportunity to talk to you. And last time we did an interview, it was back in March 2012, it was last year, and it was for episode 143 of my show. It was for the release of the debut album of the Aristocrats. So tell me a little bit more how the Aristocrat has evolved since that time.
Wow, that was so many notes ago. let me see. Well, we did the debut album. Then we basically went all around the world touring like maniacs. Mm-hmm. And gradually the true nature of all the songs on that first album revealed themselves to us. And everything just kind of evolved in a pleasing way. So we figured we should make a live album. Mm-hmm. So we did that. We got some DVD guys in to film everything. And released a live DVD called Boeing Will Do It Live.
Yeah, yeah, it was great. Great stuff in there, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then we discovered we still hadn't had enough of each other. So we figured we should make a new studio album just to kind of document whatever had happened since we got together for the first time. And I'm happy to report that's being released about a month from now. I think it's the 16th of July.
Yeah, that's what I have as a date, yeah. Out. Mm-hmm. And was it difficult to spend that much time with Marco and Brian on the road? Is it really a trial of fire for a band?
Seriously, it's great. Mm-hmm. I think we click musically and we click personally. So for those other 22 hours of the day where we're not playing music,
yeah,
and we have to endure each other's company, it's absolutely fine. We have a great time on the road.
Mm-hmm. And I did an interview with Brian Beller recently while he was in Paris to tour with Joe Satriani, and he told me that so your second studio album, which is called Culture Clash, was recorded I think in 8 or 9 days. Is it easier or more difficult to have such a time constraint like that?
I don't really think we have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
We're playing defiantly unpopular music with no singing, so that limits the commercial appeal somehow. Mm-hmm. So thing number one, there's a limit to how many days in the studio we can afford to book. And thing number two, we're all kind of busy constantly. So it was actually something of a minor miracle that we managed to get a week and a bit
mm-hmm.
all booked simultaneously to be in the same place at the same time.
And is it still 33% democracy each, the way you are running the band? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was pretty much one of the founding premises when we started this band. We said, we want this to be a democracy.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want it to be a shredder plus a rhythm section. You know, everyone co-writes, well, everyone writes material equally. And whenever there's a business decision to make or something like that, we all discuss it. And it seems to work. I think those ancient Greek dudes knew what they were doing. It's a good system.
Mm-hmm. And overall, how would you qualify the type of composition you did and Marco and Brian did on the second album compared to what you did on the first one?
I think it's better.
Mm-hmm.
all three of us feel a lot happier with what's happened on this new album. But when you say to qualify the writing, maybe I misunderstood the question. What kind of things were you fishing for there?
Well, the question is now that you know a little bit more each other, were you able to go in, a strange direction you were not able to do previously because you didn't know each other enough?
Yes, it was. It was exactly like that.
Okay.
That question was so good it didn't need any detailed answer. No, the more we've... I mean, I remember when we did the first album, we were kind of tiptoeing around each other a little bit cautiously and trying to write stuff that would sound good in our minds when we tried to picture the other guys playing, in my case, the bass parts and the drum parts. It's like, what kind of thing could I write that would sound good with Brian and Marco playing it?
Mm-hmm.
And increasingly, we've realized that we don't need to worry about that and we can just write whatever we want. And for some reason, we all kind of get it. When we all receive a demo, we all understand it on a very similar level. And I think a big part of the sound of this band comes not from what we play, but how we play it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's quite liberating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And tell us a little bit more about your three songs so you have on Culture Clash.
I don't really know how to describe them. I mean, I guess I was going through a phase of trying to explore what you can do chordally with a guitar plus a bass. If I had any theme while I was writing, it was that. It's like, can I try and come up with some massive sounding chords?
Mm-hmm.
That's always the challenge with a trio, where only two out of the three instruments can actually play notes. Like, how big and complete can you make it sound? So if anything, I'm probably more pleased with the harmonic content than the melodic content of the three tunes I wrote.
Mm-hmm. And did you come up with three songs you presented to the other guys, or did you come up with, I don't know, 10 songs and you kind of cherry-pick the one that were working the best together?
No, I came up with three.
Okay.
I almost came up with two. Because I was running so late. Mm-hmm. Everything was a race against the clock. I think for Brian it was the same thing. We were both frantically trying to finish our three tunes in less than ideal circumstances, and there's a lot of other stuff going on. Meanwhile, Marco is special. Marco constantly writes. He's ridiculously prolific.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I don't know how many demos he wrote for this album, but he sent us about 7 of them and just said, choose the ones you like. Meanwhile, I'll be writing more.
Okay. So it was some kind of a pressure on you to come up with something because you were kind of seeing where the other guys were going?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Brian and I think, probably felt the pressure equally.
Mm-hmm.
And Marco is immune to these things. He just has such a system. He's always writing music. And for me, I find it easier to write music if I'm at home for several days consecutively. Whereas Marco's dialed in this system where he can be in a hotel room anywhere in the world. And if he's got 2 hours, he'll write a tune. And if the tune needs to be finished, he'll finish it in the hotel room the next night in a different time zone. So I guess we all need different things before mm-hmm. we're comfortable to get into that writing zone.
And I think it was in the live DVD, there was a great bonus where I remember, for example, the section where Brian explained how he composed the songs, and it was really funny for me. And I talked with him about that when I met him a couple of weeks ago, that he was really badly playing the guitar to play the demo to show you what to do on the song. So what can we expect on the bonus DVD this time?
Let me think. It's mostly footage of us in the studio playing the instrument that we get paid to play.
Mm-hmm.
So you won't get so many bloopers of people playing the wrong instrument and stuff like that.
Okay.
For which I profusely apologize.
And so tell us a little bit more about how it was composed. Was it mostly live, or did you have to do a lot of takes and so on?
And we did polish some things. The idea was, as with the first album, let's get a basic take where it's just the three of us playing live in a room and we'll fix what we need to fix. Because we didn't have time to spend like 2 days per song rehearsing it and kind of dialing everything in perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a little bit of cheating where we thought it would be for the greater good. But the other main difference with this album was we abandoned our no overdubs rule. The first album, I think apart from like 20 seconds of boying I'm in the back, everything was a guitar take, a bass take, and a drum take, and it was not decorated in any way. We did allow ourselves the luxury of a few overdubs, so we'd layer some things to make the song sound prettier.
Mm-hmm.
And if people really want to hear what it sounds like as a live trio, well, they can come and see us live.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And each and every one of us did the production for your own song, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you had, I guess you had the final say on, okay, I need to add another guitar feel here and there, or I need to fix something, or let's do another take, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
On paper, I was the dictator for my three songs.
Okay.
In practice, I would welcome the input of the other two guys
mm-hmm.
on some issues.
And tell us a little bit more about what was your tone recipe to get your tone on this album.
Similar basic approach to the first album, which is all about having one main guitar, putting it into a splitter box, and then feeding two different amps. I think the trick is to make sure the gain levels of the two amps are pretty much compatible. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, strange things happen when you hear a long note decay, and it decays more on one side than the other. But once you balance the two amps up, it gives you a lot of freedom when you're mixing. I deliberately set the two amps so that they were emphasizing different frequencies. And that way you can kind of tailor the guitar sound rather than using artificial EQ. Mm-hmm. You can maybe bring in the mushy amp or bring in more of the toppy biting amp and kind of keep things sounding natural. And I do like the idea of using two amps at once.
Mm-hmm. So you record at all the time the two guitar tracks, and then it is at the mixing stage that you decide what is the portion you keep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and regarding the gain structure you have, is it all coming from the amp, or do you have some secret overdrive and boost in front of the amp?
Well, what I would describe as amp A for these sessions, as with the first album, was a Sur Badger 30, which is the amp I use for all the aristocratic live gigs as well. Mm-hmm. So I have a system I know pretty well there, with the Badger cranked all the way up, and then a Coco boost in front of it, which is a Sur pedal that basically makes the guitar louder, in effect, and pushes a certain kind of mid-range. So I didn't really use any overdrive pedals per se. It was just a boost and a kind of EQ in front of the amp. Now, the other amp was a Fender Combo, mm-hmm. which is a completely different beast. So I did use some pedals to get the level of filth matching up to what I had going on with the Badger. Mostly, I think, a pedal by Wampler, or Wampler, if I'm saying it correctly, called the Euphoria. Mm-hmm. And that's for guys who don't have a Dumble, but they want their amp to sound like a Dumble anyway.
Okay.
So it's a much cheaper way of approximating that sound. So I think that into the Fender amp, probably for 7 out of the 9 tracks. And there are a couple of points where I used a fuzz box. I have a favorite fuzz made by a company called Analog Man. Mm-hmm. The pedal's called the Sunface. It's just a very musical, quirky sounding fuzz. It brings out lots of fun frequencies. Were there any exceptions? Let me think. Two exceptions to this. One was a song called And Finally, where we experienced some kind of gremlin activity when we tracked the original take in Nashville. As soon as I'd flown home and the guys in Nashville started to work on the mix, they realized that somehow the guitar part was unusable. There were weird phasing anomalies going on, which we hadn't managed to spot while we were all there in the mm-hmm. studio. So I had to retrack that. And for the retracking, I think it was a Fender Hot Rod Deluxe with some filth pedal or another in front of it. And my old friend, the Cornford Harlequin, which is a 6-watt kind of hot rodded Marshall flavor of amp. I think the sound of that track sits fairly well with all the other stuff on the record. And then the one other exception would be Brian's crazy kind of Stray Cats on Drugs song, Louisville Stomp. So we just used the Fender for that and kind of cranked the amp reverb up all the way. Mm-hmm. And I thought it would be amusing to hire a Gretsch guitar, just because I'd never played one before. So that was a weird thing to see me in the studio with this kind of rockabilly guitar with a Bigsby Trem plugged into a Fender amp.
Yeah, I remember when I talked to Brian, he told me about this take of you playing the Gretsch, and it's a great memory for him because it was. He told me it was almost a struggle for you to play a Gretsch because it was not so easy to play as your regular guitar. Was that the case?
Well, everything's easy if you know how to play it.
Okay.
The fun thing for me was I had never played a Gretsch before, and they do kind of respond in a very distinctive way. In the same way, if you give a normal heavy metal guy a Telecaster, he will be freaked out.
Yeah.
I've played a Tele quite a lot, so I'm accustomed to the idiosyncrasies of that instrument. But you give me a Gretsch, I'm right back to square one. Mm-hmm. So I have no idea what I'm meant to do with this box. Every time I touch the Bigsby, it goes out of tune. I'm confused. But I finally figured out, well, why don't I just hit it really, really hard? The harder I hit the strings, the more it sounded like those old records. And of course, Louisville Stomp is not the easiest tune in the world. Mm-hmm. So trying to play that and hit the guitar ridiculously hard.
Yeah.
And was interesting. But I'm glad I did it that way. I think the sound that we got on the record does sound kind of authentic. Mm-hmm.
And so let's talk about your six string you played during the album. Was it the new Charvel you have?
At the time, it was the new Charvel. It's now the second newest Charvel. I have two prototypes now. The newest one has a basswood body and a birdseye maple top. But the one you'll hear on most of the album is the original Charvel prototype, which is a Koa body. Mm-hmm. And Koa is my new discovery. It's a great sounding wood. Unfortunately, it's kind of endangered and kind of very expensive. But it has everything that I like about mahogany, but it has a little bit more definition. Mm-hmm. And to my ears, it sounds like a sped up version of mahogany. You know, if you imagine recording an SG or something like that and then playing it back, sped up several semitones. So it's got that distinctive mid-range honk, but tuned a little higher up somehow. So it cuts in a fairly unique way, and it seems to complement the way I hit the strings and stuff like that. So yeah, I had a lot of fun with the Koa guitar for that, that session.
And so the how can I phrase that? The internet community was quite shocked, literally, when you moved from Sir to Charvel. Can you tell us what is your approach to how you choose your instrument, basically?
Well, I'll start by making a comment about the internet community. The internet community seems to be more interested in whether I have a new signature guitar than they are in whether there's a new Aristocrats album coming out. And this kind of disturbs me and appalls me slightly. It's important to have the right guitar, I think. If this is what you do for a living, you might as well try and find the tool of the trade that will make your job as easy as possible. Mm-hmm. But it shouldn't be the focal point. I don't think people who are interested in how I play should be obsessing over what instrument I play. Mm-hmm. Because you can give me completely the wrong guitar and it will still sound 90% like me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Partially, I go into all this detail and try all these different woods and work with these companies because I want to make my life as easy as possible. I want a guitar that helps me to make the sounds I need to make. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't be completely screwed without that particular guitar. I just wanted to get that off my chest. Dear internet, please try and give more of a shit when I release a new album and worry slightly less about whether the guitar I'm playing is a signature model or just a prototype. I feel better now.
Okay.
So what was the question? You want to know about that guitar or about...
How you pick up your next instrument. And I remember I read your comment on the internet that you were really adamant to say, well, this is not a signature model, this is just a tool I am working with, and that's it, just everybody be quiet and everything is going to be fine. So I found that this approach is quite not so usual, because we are guitar player, we so want to believe that we just have to buy the Guthrie Govan signature guitar and everything is going to be fine after that. So it was a kind of a refreshing approach to the guitar gear.
Well, I think it would be a mistake for somebody to buy a guitar just because I played it. Mm-hmm. If someone relates to the way I play and thinks I need to do a lot of that stuff that he's doing, so when I go shopping for my dream guitar, I should consider the guitar that guy is using, because presumably he's kind of thought about various problems in the design of the instrument, and maybe it will work for me as well. Mm-hmm. But you should try everything. I think it's good to shop intelligently, to know exactly what it is you're looking for in an instrument, and then don't dismiss anything. Mm-hmm. So my idea with a signature guitar is just, like, let's try and design a great guitar that happens to work for me. And then if other people have the same needs as me, hopefully it will work for them as well. But if someone buys it purely because it's got my name on it, then, you know, they almost deserve to be disappointed. Mm-hmm. Buying intelligently is a very important thing, I think.
I also have in mind several videos you did where you are playing a Surfritter from Vigier. If I'm not mistaken, there is no Surfritter on the album, or I didn't hear it?
No.
No, okay. Mm-hmm.
My apologies to France. Okay. I wanted to have a Surfritter somewhere on that album, but the way it panned out, for the nine tunes that we wrote, there wasn't really a great opportunity to incorporate fretless. I will continue to play it shocking points here and there throughout the live shows. But it just works out that way. I can play this whole album with frets, so I should probably do that. Also, the fact that I had to fly from the UK to Nashville, and flying with a bunch of instruments creates all sorts of complications. So I had to travel as light as possible.
I also had some Twitter question after I tweeted that I was about to Skype you, to interview you. And so this one is from Peter Timperley, and he asked, how much more do you want to achieve? I mean, do you have a definite plan? Okay, I want to do a second album with the Aristocrat, then I move to another project, or is it more you go from one encounter, one musical encounter to the other?
Really, I just want to carry on doing what I've always done, which is just play whatever I feel like playing and kind of keep an ear open for interesting opportunities to get involved with other musicians. So, I mean, for the rest of the year, I have a 6-week tour of the US with the Aristocrats, and then I'm touring with Stephen Wilson, and then suddenly it's Christmas. So basically the second half of this year is going to be so busy that there's no point in me making any plans. Whatever the plan is that I make, it's not going to happen in the next 6 months because I'm completely booked. I guess I should make another solo album at some point, but it's not my main priority in life to be this instrumental guitar guy who releases solo albums every year. That's not the thing that I do. I just want to play music. So maybe there will be another solo album, but I won't lose any sleep over it if it takes another 2 or 3 years to make it.
And Peter would like to know also if you are going to play in Australia.
I have no idea. Okay. I will tell Peter this. Australia is literally as far away from where I live as it's possible for any country to be. So if someone offers me one gig or one guitar clinic, then the answer is probably no, because it will take me a week to do that gig or guitar clinic, and then I'll spend the next week feeling jet-lagged and miserable. I really hope I can find an opportunity to go there. Maybe the next time I'm playing in Japan or Indonesia or something like that, so I'm halfway there, then it would make some kind of sense.
And Peter has also another last question. Do you have any tips or tricks to approach a hard music style?
To approach what music?
Harder, difficult music style to play, to enjoy.
Not really. Difficult music, that's such an open-ended concept. Difficult music is basically music that you haven't played enough already. I know shredders who find it very difficult just to play a simple reggae groove. I know blues guys who find it difficult to play Dream Theater songs. I know me, and like for me, playing classical guitar is impossible. It's a completely different instrument. So given that the concept of music being difficult is such a personal thing, I don't really know how to guide someone I've never met or heard. Except to say the following: there's no race. You know, it's not about trying to conquer something as quickly as you can. I think whatever kind of music you're trying to learn how to play, the important thing is that you start by liking it and having a genuine enjoyment that you derive from listening to that style of music. And I think the better you get to know the genre as a listener, the more finely tuned your ear is when you hear yourself practicing in that genre, and you know instinctively whether you're playing it right or not, and you have a clearer idea of which things you need to address. So if you want to practice what you consider hard music and you don't want to be wasting your time, make sure you appreciate hard music as fully as possible, and then you'll be a more informed critic of yourself. That's probably the most useful thing I could say.
And it seems that you are involved in many different projects. Is that how you avoid that? Is that your secret trick to avoid being bored about music? You go from one project with the Aristocrat, then you tour with someone else, and then you think about maybe doing a solo album. Is that how you achieve that?
I suppose that probably helps. It was never a conscious decision to be this guy who hops from one project to the next. You know, And with something like the Aristocrats, we actually do want it to be a long-term thing. We want to keep doing it and make lots more albums and do lots more gigs for many years to come. But yeah, it just seems natural to me that it should feel okay to do more than one thing. And I think it keeps you fresh as a musician. At least it keeps me fresh as a musician, maybe because of the way I learned. I never really focused on one style. I just focused on music because I like so much of music. And I've always tried to kind of absorb all the different stuff I've heard from different styles of music. So if I vow to do one thing and only one thing with my career, that's not being true to myself. I know there will be lots of things going on at the back of my mind. It's like, I want to be exploring this style as well. I want to be incorporating some of that stuff. It just feels right to do things roughly the way I'm doing them.
Mm-hmm. And
I hope that made sense.
And do you have a specific strategy to go from one step to another? Let's say you have some very specific musician you want to meet because you want to understand something they do understand and you don't. Do you seek a mentor to improve your playing, or is it again just a natural music encounter you have moving from one project to another?
It's the latter, mm-hmm. mostly. I mean, at some point in my life, I would like to go and hang out with Indian people who play classical music. And I would like them to make me feel very, very small.
Mm-hmm.
That's really one area of music where I'm completely fascinated by what they do. And I have to admit, I have no real idea of how they're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's decades of study, even to become competent at that stuff. So if I wanted to school myself like that, I guess I would need a mentor. But in terms of what I'm doing, mostly I trust myself.
Mm-hmm.
I just trust my instincts.
And at one point in time, you did a lot of teaching, and even now you do a lot of masterclass and so on. Is that something you miss, to teach the music to people, or is masterclasses enough for you to have this kind of feedback from the other musician?
Well, really, all I ever wanted to do was be a guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
And being a teacher is something that happened to me almost by accident. And there was a stage in my life where I needed to make money out of my ability to play guitar, and teaching was the only way I could pay the rent.
Okay.
So that's pretty much how it started. I do enjoy teaching when I have to do it. I think whatever you're doing, there should be some kind of mindset where you try to do it as well as you can, whatever it is, and you derive genuine pleasure from that. But it was never my goal to be a guitar teacher, so I feel positive about the fact that I'm spending more of my life playing, writing and gigging and recording, and less of my life teaching.
Mm-hmm.
My reasoning, I hope this doesn't sound arrogant because it's not intended to, but lots of people could teach you the Dorian mode, but only one person can sound exactly like me.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel it's my duty to try and sound like me rather than teaching people the Dorian mode. The masterclass situation is a nice in-between ground,
mm-hmm.
where I can be me, and the people who come are interested in whatever is going on in my mind and how I play specifically. So I guess I still get to convey some personality rather than just imparting raw information.
And regarding the masterclass, I mean, do you have very often the very same question over and over, or does it happen that sometimes you have a completely different question out of the blue and you don't know how to answer? Or is that again the same? Guthrie, can you show me how to play this very specific lick?
I try to encourage that. I want to get lost. I want to feel out of my depth,
mm-hmm.
sometimes in clinic. So I'll always encourage people to ask as many questions as possible. And the only rule is, can you ask questions that are vaguely related to guitar playing? Because that's the only thing I can do. Generally, kind of 80% of each clinic I do does end up being pretty much the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like most of the people who attend such events are concerned with the same kind of problems in their own playing. There are slight regional differences. For instance, I just did 2 and a bit weeks of clinic tour in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
every single night somebody said, so what do you think of Brazilian music? How many Brazilian musicians can you name? Mm-hmm. Every night. And I've never had a similar question anywhere else in the world. I've never had it in France or in China or in India or anything. What do you know about our music? In Brazil, everyone wanted to know that. So you get some quirks in different parts of the world. But for the most part, these days, people want to know about how do I play different styles? They want to know, how can I improvise more effortlessly? How should I practice? How should I spend my practice time? Stuff like that, which I actually welcome, because maybe 5-6 years ago, I would do a similar event, and a lot of the questions would be, how fast can you play? Mm-hmm. Which is just pointless and ridiculous. So maybe thanks to the internet and all the clinics which have been pirated and shared online without my consent, maybe that's given people a clearer idea of what to expect and a clearer idea about what it is that I would prefer to be talking about during a clinic.
And what is the most annoying question you had in a clinic?
I'm not sure.
I'm sure you have
one. Honestly, I think however bad the question is, there should normally be some way to turn it around so you give an answer that is okay. valuable in some way.
Okay, excellent. Well, it was nice to be able to talk to you again, Guthrie. I don't know, do you have a last word of wisdom to share with the beloved internet community?
Let me think now. What can I say to the internet? It's just a prototype. Buying music is cool. If you buy music, you will go to heaven. Hopefully, I'll see you on the road with the Aristocrats or Stephen Wilson. I hope you like the new Aristocrats album. We all do. I hope you're having a decent summer wherever you are right now. We're not here in the UK. Okay. Scattered thoughts. Mm-hmm. Oh, there's one other thing. One other thing I can do.
Excellent. That's the best one ever. I hope you enjoyed the interview. To engage the conversation about this episode or any other guitar-related matters, don't hesitate to post a comment on the blog, theguitarchannel.biz, ping me on Twitter, @theguitarchannel, with channel spelled C-H-N-N-L. You can also interact with me on Facebook, facebook.com/theguitarchannel, or on the Google Plus page. If you use iTunes to get the show, please post a review with plenty of stars, as it really helps to go up in the ranking. To receive the latest news about the show, please subscribe to the newsletter by going to the website. You just need to enter your email in the field in the right-hand column of the website. And for more content, like original backing tracks from the artist, avant-premiere on episodes, PDF of interviews and more, you can subscribe to the Backstage Pass for only €5 or $6.5 per month. You will get a lot of value from your money and you will support the show financially. The Guitar Channel, amplifying your passion since 2009. Until the next time, keep on playing the guitar.